Hello and welcome to 2BS Till Takeoff, the podcast inspired by conversations overheard at the airport bar. Join Phil as he grabs a couple of beers and chats with interesting people from around the world, sharing expert knowledge and hilarious stories that you won't find in your guidebook. So pull up a stool and get ready for an adventure as we explore worlds of travel and beyond with 2BS Till Takeoff.
4 hours in a Taliban headquarters.
I had dog meat in Laos.
Was it Golden Retriever?
Smack a dirty old smooch on our beautiful face right here.
He didn't die, but he fell down the side of the mountain.
Welcome to 2BS Till Takeoff. My name is Phil, and today on the show is a backpacker from England. You may know him from co-hosting his podcast, Hungry Ghost, or as the kid who bit that other kid in that viral video. Welcome to the show, Charlie Bit Me.
Yeah, that's a great reference. And I get that a lot from North Americans. That's that sticks with North Americans so much, that Charlie Bit Me catchphrase. I love it.
Dude, it was like one of the first viral videos on YouTube.
It was huge. It was absolutely huge. Yeah. And I still get it to this day. Like, oh, on my name's Charlie, hey, and you get, oh, Charlie Bit Me. It's like, yeah, not me, but I love it.
I feel like a piece of shit now. Very original, Phil.
I haven't heard it for a couple of years, so it's good to refresh the memory.
Yeah, glad I could bring those memories back up. What's going on with you, dude?
Yeah, life's good. Yeah, as you mentioned, we're bringing out season 3 of our podcast Hungry Ghost this summer, so we're just in the planning phase for that at the minute. If your listeners aren't familiar with it, it's a pretty kind of quirky podcast about food, travel and drink that I co-host with my friend Dan, who you've had on your podcast previously as well. Right. So yeah, we're pumped for that. And then yeah, as ever, just planning more trips and booking more things and paying for flights basically and trying to get out there and explore the world.
Hey you, come here. I got a secret for you. This episode is sponsored by No Days Wasted, a leader in the hangover supplement. This episode is sponsored by No Days Wasted, a leader in the summer. This episode is sponsored by No Days Wasted, a leader in the hangover supplement industry. Listeners can now get 15% off their next purchase by using promo code 2BEERS in all caps at checkout. Yeah.
And like you said, like you guys do food and drink, bit of history throughout that. What does a planning session look like? Like, is it like, hey, dude, I found this cool piece of history. Let's bring this up. Or what does that planning session kind of look like for you guys?
Yeah, it's pretty organic. I think definitely we in the third season want to get better at the planning stage of it. In season 1 and 2, we discussed topics. We choose which topics are our favorites. We kind of then go away and research separately on those subjects. And then we kind of come back together and go, okay, I found this funny thing. So a good example is we did an episode on history's greatest boozers, history's greatest drinkers, basically. So we sort of went away and you know, there's some stuff that always comes up. But then the really interesting stuff is the stuff that we find that the other person hasn't found, because that's the kind of unique, different stuff that's, you know, buried deep down somewhere on the internet. And yeah, I mean, that was a great episode. Another favorite of mine is also unusual diets. So we got into, you know, kind of the headline unusual diets, like things like fruitarianism. But then you also get into weird stuff, like there was a guy who ate a plane. So what? That's the kind of, this guy, it was a French guy. He had some mental disease where he could eat anything, basically. So throughout the course of his life, he, and it took him years to do, but he ate a small Cessna plane over several years, and along with other
medium
things.
Rare.
Yeah, sorry?
Medium rare,
exactly. Well, he's French, so he probably had it rare. I can't remember his name, but he ate bikes, he ate computers, he ate all sorts of things. He's dead now, but not due to his diet, I think, just due to old age.
Dude, I that's very interesting to eat that. I think where I'm kind of interested in that story is reporting back from the bathroom, like, what was that like?
Yeah, I think that's part of his the disease that he had that made these things kind of appetizing, or like he somehow could digest these things, and he had such strong stomach acid that it basically kind of came out okay. I mean, it can't have been great, but I think he was relatively healthy, all things considered. But yeah, it's pretty pretty insane stuff. And it was relatively recently. Like, this guy was around in, I think, the 80s. So there's, like, you know, video evidence of this stuff. It was in Guinness World Records as, like, tangible footage of this guy doing these crazy feats.
Yikes, man. You got to think of, like, if you're eating bits of plane, there has to be, obviously, metal, all this stuff, mm-hmm. like, sharp stuff going down your organs. Like,
did you die
from, like, internal bleeding or something? Like, I wouldn't be surprised.
I should have looked up before the episode. I honestly don't think he died of complications from his diet, which is unusual, like, given what he ate. But I think he just died of old age, and he lived his whole life eating these insane things. I think, yeah, there's another funny story as well. He got given a Guinness World Record for eating something. I think it was the plane, and then he proceeded to eat the physical Guinness World Record plaque as well. So yeah, there's no stopping him.
Dude, you imagine he, like, died because he, like, choked on a Skittle?
Yeah, exactly. Possibly. Maybe he was allergic to decent food. He had a steak and collapsed, perhaps.
Jesus Christ, that's hilarious. No, man. Yeah, definitely, guys, check that out. Hungry Ghost is awesome, so check them out. But like you said, Hungry Ghost, you guys focus on food and drink. And so mm-hmm. Since you're a big foodie and you've done a lot of traveling, I'd love to get your takes on some questions around food.
Yeah, sure.
And drink, obviously.
And drink.
So first one I gotta go is where's your best food destination?
That is a really good question. I think I recently went to South Korea last year, and the food there is unreal. That's definitely kind of top one or two. And Vietnam is another one where they've just got the best food on the planet. My girlfriend is Lebanese, so I'll be remiss to not say Lebanese food, which is another kind of, you know, renowned cuisine, but their food is fantastic as well.
I want to unpack that a bit.
Yeah, sure.
Because you named three really great ones. South Korea, I'm intrigued. I know, like, the bibimbaps. I know, like, the Korean barbecue, fried chicken. I know that's quite popular there as well. Is there another, like, really staple or maybe, like, a food that surprised you that you're like, oh, wow, like, what's this?
Yeah, I mean, well, the weirdest thing I ate there was live octopus. So, they're really into their fish. It's obviously, it's a peninsula surrounded by the sea. Most of their cities are right on the coast. So they're, you know, they're a big fish nation. When you're walking around the streets, there's loads. The difference, I think, between South Korean and Japanese fish kind of culture is the South Korean only fresh fish. So, like, sushi, for example, in Japan is kind of cured, frozen, and then prepared like that. Whereas in South Korea, because it's fresh, every fish restaurant has a fish tank or multiple fish tanks outside with the fish there, and then you just choose your fish. I want that one. You go inside and you have it, you know, seconds after the guy killed it, basically. And they have these huge fish markets that are incredible, where you go in, you've got rows and rows of fresh fish, shellfish, crabs. And we went and inside the fish markets, they have restaurants. So you go up to the market stall guy, you say, I want, you know, a crab. He shows you a few different crabs. You go, yeah, that one looks good. Good size, whatever. He puts it in a plastic bag. You pay him a bit of money. And then he walks you to a restaurant, gives the plastic bag to a restaurateur. The restaurateur sits you down, gets you a few beers and a bit of soju, and cooks the crab that you literally just chose 5 minutes ago from the other guy freshly for you. It's absolutely incredible.
That's a pretty cool culture, like, to do that. You can just, you know what I mean, like, they can preach that it's super fresh, but to see the process and be part of it, that's so cool.
Exactly. And you're paying you're seeing the full supply chain. You're going to the market yourself, you're buying the thing from all the different stalls, you know, you're choosing which one you want to go to, which one looks the best to you. You're speaking to that guy, he's taking you to his, you know, recommended restaurant guy who can prepare it in the best way. Their seafood is really, really super fresh. But that brings me on to the live octopus bit, which is possibly the weirdest thing I've ever eaten. Because their seafood is so fresh, and as you know, octopus, they're creatures with a huge amount, like, nervous system, and there's lots going on in kind of an octopus's tentacles, right? So they're these little octopus in tanks, probably about the size of, you know, a fist. And you order, I want the octopus, please, and they get the octopus, they cut it up, they dress it in kind of a light dressing, and they put it in front front of you. And because of all these nerves in the octopus, it's still wriggling, right? So you've got wriggling octopus on your plate. We actually had it served with on top of raw beef as well, and a cracked raw egg yolk. So it was a pretty mental, it's kind of like beef tartare, but you see the writhing of the octopus tentacles. And then when you put the octopus in your mouth with your chopsticks, because it's still got those nerves going on, you can feel the suckers sucking on your teeth as you're chewing the octopus, which is seriously intense. They say, like, if you don't chew enough, it will suck into your esophagus and choke you and you'll die. So you just put it in and you chew until you can't feel any wriggling, and then you swallow. Yeah.
Dude, Asia just has a bunch of shit that is just trying to kill you.
Absolutely.
I mean, puffer fish, yeah. Just like, there's so much shit. Like, yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah, exactly.
Quick side note. Did you watch My Octopus Teacher on Netflix?
I did. Yeah, I did.
Dude.
And that guy,
it probably made eating that meal a bit tougher, right?
I guess so. I mean, I've watched it a couple of years ago, so it wasn't like the first. If I watched the week before, it would have made that meal very tough. And these octopus are like very small. The one in that movie is, you know, they're bigger. It's a quite a big octopus, relatively speaking. So it's, you know, it's not quite the same, but yeah, it's, you know, they're very intelligent creatures, and yeah, it's pretty intense eating something that is moving and kind of fighting back in a way as you're trying to swallow it.
I the movie was very touching, to be honest. Did shed a tear. It was a tearjerker, right? You're like, but I mean, I did go out with some friends, and somebody ordered calamari, and I was like, fuck it. Like, it's delicious.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Sorry, dude, but it's delicious.
Yeah.
So yeah, you named another great one, Lebanon. Maybe highlight some of the good stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the amazing thing about Lebanon, outside of just, you know, the food itself, is the service culture. They've got such a culture in restaurants of like really, really looking after you and making you feel like you're having an amazing time, like, you know, a real guest basically. And that adds a lot to kind of the experience of eating in that country. But then also the food they have, and I'm going to butcher some of the pronunciations, I'm sure, but they obviously have the standards, you know, your hummus, your baba ganoush, your shawarmas, which I think is more like a shawarma, shawarma to us. And, you know, tabbouleh, fattoush, the salads. But then they have, you know, more unusual stuff that we don't necessarily see in kind of Western Lebanese restaurants. So they have a big raw meat kind of culture. So they have something called teble, and another dish called kibinayir. And both of these are essentially raw minced beef. That you eat. They're prepared slightly differently, but essentially they're what the teble is basically just pure pink looking beef, and then the kibinayir is beef mixed with some bulgur wheat but still raw, so it's a bit darker in color. And again, you know, as with many kind of these kind of types of dishes around the world, it's sort of seen as being quite masculine to eat it, you know, a sign of virility to eat it. And they also serve it with onions and arak, which is their version of kind of raki or ouzo, you know, the kind of
Middle Eastern. Arak goes arak around, dude. I think there's arak in Sri Lanka as well.
They serve it with that. So the point is, like, the onions and the arak will kill off any bacteria that's on the raw meat, basically. And then another weird one they have is a dish, I think it's called asafir, which translates literally just to birds. And it's tiny, tiny little birds that they shoot kind of en masse. They cook them all up in like a pomegranate molasses sauce. So it gets really, really sticky. The whole bird, like, they take the feathers off, obviously, but the whole bird with bones. And then, you know, you've got this really sticky little kind of, you know, chicken popcorn sized thing almost. And you just munch it down with all the bones and crunch it down. And it's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty intense as well. Pretty gamey, but it's, you know, it's nice. Nice enough.
I've heard it's quite a bit of a night out too in Beirut. I remember I took a cab and I was in Boston, and the guys, he was from Lebanon, and it was just asking him about Lebanon stuff. And I'll always remember, he's like, Beirut's the type of place where you smoke 3 cigarettes at once. And I was like, hell yeah, dude, I want to go there.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, in a way, the party capital of the Middle East, because it's got a huge Christian population. So, you know, lots of other countries in the region, they don't have a big alcohol culture. There's, you know, it's forbidden in many of the countries because of the religion. Whereas when you've got a load of Christians living in a place who don't have those same restrictions on them from a religious point of view, they like to party. So, the laws are less strict. So that means that people can come there and party basically. So yeah, the nightlife there is incredible. They've got, you know, these massive super clubs like on the right on the port, on the marina. It's kind of hard to comprehend, and you're like, why like they're like five enormous mega clubs just here in Beirut? But yeah, they're there, and it's really, really cool.
Nice, that's awesome. That was a really complete answer. I feel like that was awesome. Thank you. You're super knowledgeable. I've got more questions, obviously, but this is great.
Awesome.
With the best comes the worst.
Mm.
Where is your worst food destination?
I think personally, I've never really liked German cuisine. I love Germany. And it's probably, I'm sure you've had other guests in the past who've talked about Germany and what an amazing country it is, but the cuisine is not the best. I went to Munich, for example, for Oktoberfest. Don't know if you've ever been to Oktoberfest.
Twice,
yeah. Well, you'll know it's basically, it's pretzels, it's sausages, and it's boiled potatoes. That's basically it.
Yeah, and baked chicken, I guess you can get like a quarter chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very bland.
Very, very bland, very samey. Not that exciting. I went to Oktoberfest with a vegetarian friend, and she really, really struggled because, you know, there's not much there. So we did one of the cardinal sins of traveling, and we went to the Hard Rock Cafe in Munich so that she could have she could have some vegetarian food, which is not one of my proudest moments. But, you know, possibly there's limited other options for her out there.
Some people will fight you on this for Germany, though, because they do claim the Döner Kebab.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the Turkish people in Germany. So I'm going to say that's a Turkish dish that's, you know, it's evolved and it's changed, and it is great in Germany. And it's its own thing. It's separate to the Turkish version, but, you know, that's Turkish influence, not German influence. I think we can agree on that.
I think you're right. It's just that they don't want to acknowledge that.
That's true. How many listeners do you have from Germany who are going to piss off with this?
Now zero, probably.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I spent I studied a year in Germany, and dude, yeah, like I'd say the food was fine.
Mm.
Wouldn't say that there's anything that, like, I'm the only thing I'm dying for is a Döner Kebab, but I think you can get that in Turkey or anywhere in the Middle East.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So, other than that, the beer is fantastic.
The beer is absolutely phenomenal. Give them props for their beer. I'm also thinking of another story that also leads me to say Germany as well. As I went on German exchange in year 9. So that's kind of, I think, similar to like grade 9, I guess, in North America. It's when you're like 13, 14, you go and spend a week with a German family. And then some other time, the German child and that family comes and spends a week with your family.
Right.
And I was, you know, first time I'd ever kind of gone on holiday without my parents, and they served me a piece of meat that I'd never seen before in my first night in their house. And I just was just so confused as a, you know, a little boy. And I was just like, I'm out of my comfort zone, culture shock for the first time kind of thing. And I was like, I'm really homesick. And I was just like mentally scarred. And I had no idea what this piece of meat ever was. But I think it just put me off of German food for life, maybe. Years later, I went to Ukraine and I ordered a pork knuckle. And the pork knuckle came, and I was like, holy shit, that's what the Germans gave me 10 years ago. Now I know what it is. It was a pork knuckle, and it was delicious. But at the pork time,
knuckle.
Obviously.
Yeah, pork knuckle's sick.
Yeah.
Where were you in Germany?
I was in Braunschweig, which is Germany. Yeah.
That's interesting. Actually, that place, Braunschweig, I think there's the province that I'm in is New Brunswick, and I think that it got its name, it derives from Braunschweig.
Exactly. I was going to double check that. I was going to say the same thing. Yeah. In English, kind of, you know, translation, Braunschweig becomes Brunswick. Yeah.
Crazy. Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really cool, man. We touched on the octopus being a weird food, but maybe, I know you've traveled quite a bit. You have to have another weird food that you've had.
I think a very controversial one that we had in Vietnam, and probably the worst thing we ate in Vietnam from a taste perspective was dog.
Yes. You're the second one that comes on this podcast that's eaten dog. And my question to you, was it golden retriever?
No, it was like kind of generic mutt.
Was it like in South Korea where you had to go pick it out?
No, we didn't pick it out. No, thank God. We just went into the restaurant and we sort of, you know, I think it was like not a tasting menu, but, you know, we just ordered the dog and it came as a soup. It came as a salad-y thing. It came just the meat. So we got a selection basically of it prepared in kind of three or four different ways. And they were all bad. And, you know, it was, I would describe it as kind of like a less good version of pork. It just wasn't. It wasn't very nice at all. So I wouldn't have it again. I wouldn't recommend it, but you know, when in Rome, you got to try these things, I guess.
I think personally, I would eat insect before I'd eat dog. I'm not shitting on you for eating dog.
Yeah.
Respect to you, but I don't know if I could do it. Yeah. That's like the one, I think I'd eat like a gross ass bug before doing that. Like,
yeah, I get that. Yeah. I completely get that. And I wouldn't do it again. But yeah, it's another one of those things that's like about virility as well. And like, you know, masculinity, it's just like, it's not very nice, but when things aren't very nice, they sometimes get billed as being to increase your libido, just to make you buy them, maybe the marketing campaign.
Dude, you're gonna be popping kids so soon. I want to talk about some underrated food destinations.
Yeah,
ones that maybe people don't know as much about. Ones that, you know what I mean, we know the Italy's, we know the you know what I mean, the Mexico's. What are the ones that you're underrated ones, the ones that people don't know about?
Yeah.
They should go check out.
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like because I'm such a foodie, I tend to go to destinations because I want to try specific things. But I mean, maybe controversially, I think England is a great food destination. I'm obviously from there.
Oh, wow.
We have some, you know, we get a lot of stick around the world for the quality of our food.
Tikka masala.
Yeah, chicken masala.
Boiled food.
You've got sausage rolls. You've got cottage pie, Yorkshire puddings, the Sunday roast. Doesn't get better than a Sunday roast. So I think we have some pretty good food. I think, you know, lots of people probably come to London and they go to like a traditional pub that's like a chain pub and just serves crap. But, you know, if you go into the right places, or, you know, as with any country, like home cooked food by, you know, someone's mum or someone's gran, like that's, you know, really, really incredible stuff. And, you know, heartwarming as well, I think, which is one of the great things about British cuisine. But I get that it's not beloved by everyone. Beans on toast, another controversial one that...
Oh, fuck off. Fuck off.
So my girlfriend, is Lebanese, so she's never tried beans on toast, but I'm going to make her try it in a few weeks' time. We've put it in the diaries, like, this is the day we're going to have beans on toast together. And I'll report back, Phil, because she's going to be blown away.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had it, to be honest. I've had beans, I've had toast. I've probably had beans touch my toast at eating breakfast or something.
Yeah.
But to purposely put beans on toast.
Are we talking about like your beans or our beans?
How do your beans differ?
So our beans are less sweet, I think, than certainly like beans from the United States. And I assume Canadian beans are similar to their beans. Our beans are more savory thing.
Yeah. You can get the sweeter kind of maple syrupy ones. You can also get more of the savory, like the pig fat ones.
Right. Yeah.
So I think we get maybe both. For you, like, is there a specific brand? Like, I know we do get some of your food in our grocery stores in the international section. So would it be like a Heinz one or something like that?
Heinz baked beans in the green tin. There's also Branston that people like. I'm a Heinz person. I'd say most people go with Heinz. Yeah. I'd say most people go with Heinz. Some people say Branston, but yeah, it has to be Heinz. And grated cheddar cheese on top. So good.
Okay, dude. Listen, I'll try to find it, and I might just post a video of me trying it and give it you know.
Do it.
I don't know. I don't know what catchy word could be, like how many how many stars or how many beans out of anyways, we'll figure something out. But yeah, I'll try that before I'll try golden retriever. Let's just say that.
Yeah, good idea. It's much nicer.
So Charlie, I got another one for food, and I want to. So we talked about kind of the blue chip countries for the best foods. The, you know, like the Italy's, the the Mexicos, the Englands, and I want to know, out of the blue chip ones, the ones that the people know, what are the ones that the food lives up to the hype?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for me, I think the one that transcends the hype almost for me is Mexico. I think certainly, look, in the UK in particular, we don't really have a big Mexican population. We're not close to Mexico, so our Mexican food here is pretty crap. But if you seek it out, or if you cook it yourself at home, you can have some good Mexican food. But when you go to Mexico and you walk up to a little taco truck, you'll have the best taco you ever had in your life, and I absolutely love that. It's so cheap, but it's just really, really incredible quality. And it's across the whole country. You can go anywhere in Mexico and just have the best food. I'm a big fan of spice and chili, so I really love kind of particularly Mexican food and Indian food for that reason. But I think for me, Mexican is it really does live up to the hype. It is a fantastic cuisine, and it's so varied but so interesting.
Hell yeah, viva Mexico. On board with you there. Where did you go in Mexico?
So I spent 3 months living on a beach in a place about 40 minutes or maybe 40 an hour south of Tulum. So Tulum, this was in 2010, but Tulum now has become this influencer tourist destination. In 2010, there was no one there. It was great. We lived on the beach. I was doing this volunteering scheme where we were measuring the health of the coral reefs that basically go down that whole coast of Mexico. It's called the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef, and it's the biggest coral reef after the Great Barrier Reef, obviously, in Australia. So it's the second biggest in the world in Mexico. So we were living there, we were diving, scuba diving every day, and just checking out this reef and measuring its health, basically. So it was pretty sweet living on the beach in Mexico, drinking all the Mexican cervezas, popping into town to Tulum to get your tacos and your supplies. And I'm a bit, obviously, as you have seen Tulum since then become this thing online where all these influencers go, and I don't know if I could ever go back, really. I think it's when something's been so special for you and you've lived somewhere, but then you've seen how it's changing, it's kind of like it would probably ruin it for me a bit to go back to Tulum now, seeing what it's become. I'd be very interested to, but it might be a mistake.
Yeah, like the old place that you probably live is now McDonald's.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or a luxury resort that people are paying thousands of pounds a night to go to, as we got to just live there in kind of huts, basically.
That's a great answer, dude. I personally, North Americans, we like Mexico's a very popular destination. I think it's probably one of the cheaper countries to just fly to.
You're right.
From Canada. I've personally gone off resort for, I'll be very honest, for a short amount of time, but we did get some good quesadillas, some good tacos, like you said, the food's insane. There's a few other spots that are kind of heating up, I guess, in the same type of popularity as Tulum, but Puerto Escondido, just kind of on the west coast across from there, I think is kind of, if you want to go now, because it's going to be ruined maybe in a year or two, same thing is kind of what happened to Tulum. But yeah, it's definitely a region that we were looking forward to doing and just kind of escaped for better flight deals. Or maybe that it was just a bit more expensive. The flight deal was a bit more expensive, but the typical price, for example, Peru was $100 more. So it was the value was a lot bigger.
Yeah, it was so much further. And you might not get that Peru deal another time, but you're definitely going to get a good Mexican deal at some point in time.
Right. So we've done food. Now let's do drink.
Yeah.
I might play along here with you, but what is your best beer country?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, we've obviously spoken about Germany. Maybe it gives Germany a bit of redemption here, because Germany is a phenomenal beer country. I mean, obviously they have the, I think it's the Rheingebirgsgewalt, whatever, you lived in Germany, so you might know more than me how to pronounce it. But the purity laws about what can be in beer is really, really strict in Germany. That means you get a very, very high quality product. Where else is a good, I mean, the USA and Canada as well. I think there's so much diversity, kind of completely flipping the coin away from Germany. Germany got a few very good types of beer, but not much range within that. And then in the US and Canada, You guys have so much diversity. You can go to most bars and have a really fantastic choice of beer.
A lot more craft beer as well in North America.
Yeah, exactly. You get the craft, you get all those crafty stuff. You get the IPAs, dark beers, all sorts of things, sours, goes, they can be really experimental. The options are there. You go into bars, have 20 different things on tap, which is, incredible range. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I go best beer for me is, as much as I do love Germany, I'm going to go Czech Republic.
I've not been to the Czech Republic, so I'd love to go.
Czech Republic is a wonderful country for beer. I think they are the country that drinks the most per capita. I think it's like 180 liters per person per year.
Yeah.
Like it's insane.
That's basically, it's a pint a day, basically. I think it works out on average, but
pretty much.
Do a lot of that at the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. But I think one of the reasons is obviously super cheap and, they just have a big culture, a big beer culture like Germany would. So I got the chance to go to Prague a few times, went to Brno as well, which is like the second biggest city in Czech Republic. Didn't have a chance to go to Pilsen, where I think Pilsner or Kel's from.
Yeah.
Probably. But the beer there is insane. It's the big difference there is that the large head, right? The difference between, I think there's like a really weird North American culture where like, if you have a head, like a big head, it's like, oh, that's a bad, it's a bad beer. You can't, it's a bad way to pour the beer. But actually the head is the kind of the buffer between the oxygen and the beer, which if oxygen hits your beer, makes it bitter. So in Czech Republic, you're going to get a quarter of your glass is going to be the head, right? So they're pretty big on that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting as well. Cause like, yeah, similar here in the UK, people are very pernickety about the size of the head. And we'll send a pint back if it's too big. And they'll say, I want more beer in my pint and less head. But it's interesting that other cultures see it differently and see it as a positive thing and a protective thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, we go from best to worst. Where's your worst beer country?
It's a very tough question. I feel like there's so many countries just have one generic lager, right? You go to many Mediterranean countries. I don't want to name any particular names, but it's basically they have one brand and that's it, and it tastes the same as any kind of generic lager. So I think kind of not going to name a specific country, but I just think if you don't have range and variety and you just have got one or two products that are basically taste the same, then that's kind of not exciting as a beer drinker. I'll still enjoy it and it tastes great in the sun, but it's not as exciting as some of the stuff that you get in more advanced beer countries like Germany and North America.
Sure. And just to let Charlie, this podcast, people tune in for the opinions, so for me, I can't plead the fifth on the question. So I'm gonna say France right off the bat. I'm gonna go right for it. I don't even care. France's beer sucks. Kronenbourg is probably my last choice. It's terrible, especially considering the countries that border it. I don't know if that's the reason why, but for me, the beers that I've had in France, I was like, bro, pass. I will redeem them a little bit because their wine and champagne culture is so good that they kind of forgot beer. So France, you're amazing for wine and champagne. Beer, don't, no, just stop.
I can't even think about obviously they've got Kronenbourg, but like I can't even picture drinking like a decent beer in France. So yeah, France is definitely one of them.
We did also miss beer best beer country, Belgium is also fucking underrated.
Yeah, Belgium is incredible as well. Talking about like best beers as well, I mean, have you been to the UK, Phil?
Yeah, dude, I've been to Bognor Regis.
Oh, okay. Yeah But did you have a real ale when you were in the UK?
I think so, maybe.
Yeah, so real ale I think is like, it's a type of beer that basically only seems to exist in the UK, and it's served at room temperature. It's flat. It's kind of a dark brown color.
I didn't have that. No.
Yeah, it's very. Maybe it's like another the beer version of beans on toast, right? It's something that like British people love, but like other people are like, "What the hell is this?" There's no bubbles and it's warm. But it's beer that has been made in that way for before lager existed. Lager as a product is very only kind of has existed for about 150 years, because it's quite technical to make it. But before then, what they were making was kind of live conditioned ales, like what we in the UK now call real ale. Kind of much, you know, it's a live product because the yeast is still fermenting in the beer in the barrel, and there's no kind of, you can't add CO2 or anything into it because that technology didn't exist. But we still drink loads of it in the UK, but it's definitely an acquired taste, I think.
To be honest, Charlie, I didn't spend a ton of time in England. I literally left Europe on my first trip and had to fly out of the Schengen area in terms of like for visa purposes. Like I was just
out of time. 90 days. And
And I was also out of money. So I didn't spend, I spent a bit of time in Scotland and then literally took a bus from Edinburgh to the south to Portsmouth, got on a regional bus from Portsmouth to Bognor Regis to where my buddy was living. And I tried to pay with Scottish pounds. And like, I had no idea. I was like, I don't know, dude. I go to the bus and the guy's like, we can't take that. I'm like, what do you mean?
Yeah, he can take that. He can.
But he was very resistant.
He was very resistant and they will resist. But like, it is legal tender to use Scottish money in England. But a lot of places will just reject it because they don't want to have to deal with the, you know, the potential that it's fake or whatever, because they just don't recognize it. So it's just, you know, reject something you're not familiar with kind of thing.
Yeah, shout out to Scotland, but also another country that has shit beer.
Yeah, I mean, their only big beer brand is Tennent's, which is crap.
It's okay, great Scotch, but it's the same concept as France, right? You spend a lot of time on one alcohol and the other might suffer a little bit, which is I think the case.
I agree. As there's some good kind of craft beers in Scotland, so one that springs to mind is one called Pilot Brewery, which is in Leith near Edinburgh. They make some phenomenal beers, but like certainly mass market in terms of widespread distribution, it's only really Tennent's and it's crap.
Best random local alcohol. We mentioned Arak earlier. Ooh. that's the vibe I'm going, the you know what I mean, like not the vodkas, not the rums, not the staple alcohols that are well known around the world, the random ones that you're just like, what the fuck's this?
Yeah, I can tell you the worst, which is,
that was actually the next question, so we can start with worst.
That one springs to mind immediately. It's something called Aguardiente, which is from Portugal.
It's in Colombia as well, and that was my fucking thing too.
It's fucking horrible. It's rough as like drinking sick almost, but like alcohol, you know, you get the ethanol flavor but the taste of sick, and it's just rancid. So that springs to anyone who's had that, I think, could probably say like it's such like a, you know, in your brain from years ago, and like that's why it sprang to mind so immediately. In terms of the good ones, I think Arak is definitely up there, and you know, Raki or Ouzo in Greece. Like I love that aniseedy flavor. It's something you drink, you mix with water, and you drink it quite slowly. You have it with a meal. There's a lot of ritual around it. And then I also really like Slivovitz, which is kind of plum brandy that they make in Eastern Europe. So
where specifically?
So I've had it in Hungary, but I believe they make it possibly under a different name.
I think it's Palinka, but I've had it under in Hungary.
Yeah. So I think Palinka's maybe slightly different.
I think it's from plums.
I could be wrong. I don't want to get misquoted here, but certainly in that kind of Eastern European north, you know, Hungary down to kind of the Balkan region, you've got Palinka really, really good, and then you've got Slivovitz as well. Maybe Slivovitz is the Czech version of it.
I'm intrigued. Let me just check.
Yeah,
Slivovitz. It is produced in Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. Doesn't necessarily say exactly where it's from. So, dude, it could be more than one alcohol from primary producers, Bosnia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Czech, Greece, Hungary. Yeah, there you go. So it's Hungary as well.
Yeah, I'm just reading as well. So it's in Hungary, it's considered a type of Palinka, basically. So
same thing then.
Yeah. So that is really, really good. Very, very drinkable. You can, you know, get pretty tanked up on those pretty quickly and have a great night. Pretty cheap as well.
Especially in Hungary. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I think my best one is, I'm stuck between two, but South America screams at me when I hear this, in terms of best random alcohol. It's I'll start with Cachaça, which is from Brazil.
Incredible.
It's, I think with the drink in the it's the alcohol in Caipirinha, that's my favorite one to have. And also the reason why I think it's the best is because we got super drunk once when we were in Brazil and ended up getting it tattooed on our body. So me and a buddy. So that's definitely one that's memorable.
Now you have to say that for the rest of your life that it's your favorite. Otherwise,
exactly. I also really love Pisco. Pisco in Peru or Chile, depending on, I know there's a big fight between who really has invented it. And like literally you'll go to Peru and see that if there's Chilean Pisco, they've scratched out Pisco because they're like, that's not Pisco.
Wow.
But anyway, so they make really nice Pisco sours there. That's another drink that's, it's you know, it's somewhat similar in taste, different texture, obviously, with the sour and the egg, the raw egg, but it's two fantastic drinks that you can have, you know, in the drinks or kind of by themselves too.
Yeah. I haven't drank much Pisco on its own, but I've enjoyed a Pisco sour or two in my time. And it's a phenomenal drink, like twist on a sour, right? It's so good.
Yeah. So like I was telling you there recently, we're getting married and that's actually going to be our signature drink at our wedding. Because we got engaged in
Peru. Nice. Ah, okay. Brilliant. Mm. Very, very nice. So will you have a Peruvian bartender coming up to make it the Peruvian way, or will you be getting a Canadian to do it?
Probably a Canadian. Weddings are fucking expensive, dude. Holy shit.
Yeah. You can maybe find a Peruvian who lives in New Brunswick.
Probably not, but we'll try. New Brunswick is, I think we're like 850,000 people and the country, the province size is approximately Germany size.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So a lot of woods. Last question for you in the cocktail section. Where's your favorite bar in the world?
Oh, that's a very good question. Can it be a pub or are we talking bar?
Bar, pub, place that sells alcohol.
So I did have an answer for about 10 years and it's a kind of never meet your heroes thing again. I went there about 10 years ago for the first time. It's a place called the Claggy Inn, which is in the west coast of Scotland and beautiful, beautiful part of the world. Incredible mountains, incredible scenery. It's a proper kind of hiker's pub. I went there with some mates on a night. They had loads of beers on offer, real ales. They had a incredible Scotch whiskey range. They had live music and it was just one of the best nights I've ever had. And I've always sort of thought like, that's my favorite pub. If anyone asked me that question, that's my favorite pub. Unfortunately, I went back like a couple of years ago for lunch because I was driving past and we just had an awful time. Like the food was crap and like it took ages to arrive. And it was just like really disappointing. I told my friends, I was like, we're going to this amazing pub. I had such a good time there. Like 10 years ago, we're going to go there. And then I felt like I'd kind of let them down because I'd brought them here and it was just a rubbish experience. So kind of, you know, sadly with regrets, I'll have to say it's no longer the Claggy Inn in Fort William in Scotland, Glencoe in Scotland. My new favorite pub that I went to just a week ago was a bar called or a pub called The Front, which is in Falmouth in Cornwall. So we were in Cornwall for Easter, which is, if anyone doesn't know, kind of the furthest and most southern bit of England. It's a little bit of England that points out.
Is that southwest?
Yeah, the most southern western bit of England. And we were walking through the town and there was no one in the town on a Friday night. And we were like, it was raining to be fair. So we're like, okay, everyone just must be at home because it's raining and whatever. We'll just walk into a random pub. And we walked into the first pub that we saw, which was The Front. And everyone, we were like, oh, this is where everyone is. The pub was absolutely heaving. It was really just like a great atmosphere. It had kind of it's hard to describe, but like a really good pub smell. Like it felt like it was just like
old wood.
Wood and comforting. And, you know, and then the beer range was fantastic. They had like only locally made stuff. There were no big brands behind the bar. It was all just like proper stuff from the area or like other breweries that they work with around the country that they know are good. And then also, you know, a great thing about it was we were looking around and there was everyone was eating fish and chips. And we were like, well, the pub doesn't do food, but upstairs was a fish and chip shop. So that they had had a deal with the chippy that you could go and you could get your chippy and you could bring it into the pub and have a pint. So we obviously did that. And we went and had an absolutely incredible fish and chips, brought it down into the pub, sat down, had a few pints and, you know, just had a brilliant time. And also what was great about it was like multiple different locals came and sat on our table as we were there just because there was not much space, so they needed somewhere to sit. But we got chatting to them about their lives, because it's on the coast, so a lot of them were like working on boats, working at sea, and were in Falmouth kind of, you know, in their downtime. And it was just, you know, it was just a very lovely, warming, comforting pub, and it was a great experience.
Nice. It's this question is a bit flawed, because it's had you gone a day that there was nobody there, you would have not even considered that. So that your experience, you know, your connection with the people there, you know, if there's a great band that day, like, you know what I mean? Like, the bar could have the bones for a great pub or the best pub in the world, but if nothing's happening or there's nobody there to really connect with, it's not that great.
Exactly. Like the example that I gave in the first example, the pub in Scotland was great one time, 10 years later, exactly the same building, exactly the same location, but it was a crap experience because of, you know, it didn't have the same atmosphere for whatever reason on that day. But yeah, I think that's the thing about pubs and bars in general. It's not just about the building or the product, the drink you're drinking, because you can have that drink, sat on your sofa from the supermarket, from the grocery store. It's about actually being around other people and the atmosphere and everything else that's going on that makes pubs and bars really special, rather than what you're eating or what you're drinking. Whereas with restaurants, you know, restaurants make stuff you generally can't make at home, so that the food becomes very special. Whereas with drink places, it's more about the atmosphere than the drink itself, I think.
Exactly. I'm going to give you two. My quick answer off the bat is Cheeks in Bognor Regis, Cheeks nightclub.
Really? a nightclub in Bognor Regis is not what I thought you were going to say. For a number man one, as well traveled as yourself, far. Far in the world. Is it still open?
I don't even know. It's right on the water. It's beautiful. No, I just witnessed some stuff that night that I think it was one of the funner nights out I've had when I was in England. But... I'll give you one in Canada that I really like. It's a place in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and it's so my fiance used to live in Halifax, and I used to go up every few weeks, and there was this one place it's called Henry House, and it's this bar that's three floors, so you kind of have the restaurant on the main floor, the basement's kind of the pub, but on the top of the building is like this Scotch room, and it's fucking awesome. It's like if I can only describe it as like rich mahogany, like everything is kind of dark brown, you know what I mean? Like a fireplace.
Yeah.
Like it is a bar. Brilliant. And we talked about connecting in a bar, but that was like if I were to imagine like a super cool bar, that's what it would be. Like everything's kind of wood, like leather, like big chairs.
Yeah.
And he would do a lot of smoke drinks there. So you'd have the smell of smoke kind of, it was a little like mysterious. Anyways, I just thought it was fucking awesome there. So it's a little bit of a hidden gem in Halifax, but it's one that I really enjoyed.
Well, I'll be sure to go if I ever make it to Halifax one of these days.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Kind of switching gears here, I want to talk about, you're a big hiker.
I was
wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about your experiences hiking and maybe give us some recommendations.
Yeah, so I've done... So every year, me and a couple of friends do a kind of multi-day hike somewhere in Europe. So talking kind of five days of hiking, basically, and then a couple of travel days either side. So it's a nice way to kind of spend some time hiking, but not mega, mega long distances, because we've all got jobs and, you know, other commitments, etc. So this year, we're going to be going to walk in May. So in a month's time, we're going to be going to walk the Chemin Le Puy, which is in south of France. So it's near Lyon. Don't know what it's going to be like yet, but it looks amazing. But then the two that I've done recently that I would absolutely recommend to anyone. So the one we did 2 years ago was the Camino del Norte in northern Spain. So people are probably familiar with the Camino de Santiago, which is a series of pilgrimage routes all across, well, not just Spain, but also Portugal, France. There are some routes that start in England as well. That all end up in Santiago de Compostela in Spain, in Galicia. The main one that people tend to do is the French way, the Camino Francés, it's called. That's kind of like the classic one. I think like 80% of people do that one. We did the Camino del Norte, which is the Camino of the North, the Way of the North. And that hugs the coastline all the way from a town called Irun, which is sort of north-northeastern Spain, all the way along the northern Spanish coast, basically. So we started kind of about 30 kilometers west of Irun in San Sebastian, and then it goes through the Basque countryside. Incredible scenery in the Basque country. It's just phenomenal, beautiful, beautiful place. Great mountains, but great, you know, right on the seafront as well. And then we walked to Bilbao, and then it continues on to Santander, and then onwards down into Galicia, and then Santiago. But walking through the Basque country, man, is so enriching. Like it's a place that has such a phenomenal history. It's kind of its own independent, you know, territory within Spain. They see themselves not as Spanish, but as Basque first. Mm. They have their own Basque national football team. They're very, very proudly not Spanish. And you get a sense of that a little bit in the cities like San Sebastian, but when you're in the rural countryside, you really start to feel their animosity towards the Spanish. Like you see posters with the Spanish president as a devil, the captain of the Spanish football team with his eyes crossed out, displays sort of saying free the Basque prisoners, because the Spanish government still has a lot of their terrorists or freedom fighters, depending on how you look at it. They still have a lot of people who are involved in the terrorist organization ETA locked up in Spain. But these people are from these sorts of villages, and the villagers are sort of still saying to this day, you know, free our prisoners because we want to be an independent state, basically. So you get to see some pretty interesting stuff walking through these places. They're obviously super friendly to British people, right? They've got no beef with us. Mm. But you feel that, you know, you're not really in Spain and you're actually in something that's quite different, but very, very interesting. And it has, you know, has its own language, the Basque language, that's I think a language isolate. So exactly. It's not related to any of the other European languages. They have their own brilliant wine. They have, incredible food. I absolutely loved the Basque country. Have you been to the Basque country, Phil?
Yeah, I've been to the border of it, I think. I've been to San Sebastian.
Yeah.
And so is it like instead of tapas, it's pinchos or whatever?
Pinchos. Yeah, pinchos, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, I think they sort of say that that's the originator of tapas, but it's basically like in any bar in the Basque country, you walk in and the bar is covered with different types of kind of, you know, basically little bread things with fish or meat or eggs or whatever. Mm. And you sit down, you order your beer or your wine, and you say, I want one of them, pick out, you know, three or four little bites, enjoy that, pay, go and do the same thing next door, you know, and continue on. And that's your night, is walking around sampling little morsels of delicious, tasty cuisine.
It's also a hangover cure.
Yeah.
Eating as you go.
Mm, yeah.
Some people say eating's cheating, absolutely. But I mean, it also is not causing you major damage the next day. So,
yeah. We had a kind of crazy experience there with an Israeli guy. It was in his 80s. So he was this guy called Eddie. So my friend, two of us flew to San Sebastian, and then another friend got the bus from Biarritz in France. So we met the friend and he was sort of telling us about his bus journey. And he was like, well, I met this guy on the bus. He's 80-year-old called Eddie. He's he's from Argentina, but now he lives in Israel. And we were like, okay, cool. That sounds funny. And then he was like, oh, there he is. We were just walking down the street. He was like, oh, that's the guy I was just talking about. There's Eddie there. And we were like, oh, shit, that's weird. So we got talking to Eddie, and then we were like, do you want to come for a drink? So Eddie just came for a drink with us, and we did all this bar hopping that I just described with this 80-year-old Israeli guy who wasn't the best at English, but we could communicate, and we had a great time with him chatting about his life. And then he came and met us the next day for lunch, and we just had a funny kind of time in San Sebastian with this guy, and hopefully kind of gave him quite an interesting experience and a different experience that he might have had. He was traveling on his own, but for, you know, a day and a half, he got to hang out with three English lads who like drinking, so I hope you enjoyed that.
No, that's fun, man. Like sometimes the people that you meet, you never know. For example, like you never thought you'd like, yeah, I'm gonna go hang out with an 80-year-old from Argentina that lives in Israel. Like I remember I was there with my mom in San Sebastian. We hung out with two like Australian girls that we had met in Barcelona, and they were like, oh, we're in San Sebastian. We're like, oh shit, like, hey, let's meet up again, you know what I mean? Like it was it's just the people you meet abroad is so cool. Regarding your hike though, what was the level of difficulty to do that Costa del Norte?
Yeah, the Camino del Norte is seen as like the hard one, basically. So the French way is the most popular, as I said, and it's, I believe, the most, I've not done it, but I believe it's seen as kind of the easy one, or the easier one. It's, you know, still hundreds of kilometers of hiking. It's not, I'm not saying it's easy, but the Camino del Norte, I believe, is seen seen as kind of the harder one, because it's going through that region of kind of the Basque Country and Santander and kind of further west, where it's all mountains all the way along. So it's just up and down constantly, up and down huge mountains, carrying kind of, I think I had about 12 kilograms maybe on my back, which isn't heavy for a one-day trip, but when you're doing multiple days with that on your back, it gets seriously painful. We met some guys who were camping, and these guys carrying all their tents and stuff with them as well, which just, and all their equipment to heat their food, so that adds more and more weight on. So we were staying in accommodation, so we didn't have any of that to worry about, but it was a serious challenge.
So when you say it's difficult, like, what's, can you maybe just talk through like what you mean by difficult? Because difficult obviously is subjective, but like, you know, if somebody's just random person who is interested in doing this walk, what can you expect on a daily basis?
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. So I think you can expect a lot of mountains up and down. For me also, I've got quite bad knees. So for me, the downhills are really, really painful. I learned on that trip to take walking poles with me on any kind of big hike, because they help to soften the blow on your knees each time you step on either up or down. I think depending on the time of year that you go, the heat is always going to be an issue. It's a Mediterranean country, even though you're not on the Mediterranean coast in the north of Spain, but it's still hot. We went in October and it was boiling. And then also really? Kind of, it was cold at night, but it was hot in the daytime. It was, shorts, t-shirt, factor 50 sun cream.
For an English guy.
Yeah, well, exactly. Only for an English guy. I think like we were walking on average about 25 kilometers a day. We did some big days that were like 30 plus kilometers. And it's those bigger days that also they wipe you out for the next day, because you pushed yourself too far the day before. And then you've got to get up and do it again the next day, where it gets really, really kind of mentally challenging. One thing as well, that was actually in the Sicily trip. So this is the Sicily trip we did last year, and we walked from Palermo to Agrigento, which is basically north to south on the western side of Sicily. But the amount of dogs that they have in these kind of Mediterranean countries that are not like dogs you get in England. They are scary mofos, and they're gonna come at you. And the farmers don't give a shit about, like, they're farm dogs, but the farmers don't give a shit about locking them up. They don't really they just leave them on the loose. And we were in a Facebook group, because it's good just to do some research, and every single comment was like, be wary of the dogs. The dogs, like, will get you. One of my friends who I was with has a massive phobia of dogs, so that was like a huge issue for him. And we ended up buying like mace for dogs, because in a hiking shop, because they, like, it's such a problem there that's like a thing hiking shops sell.
Shit. So were you like, dog, stay away from me or else I'm going to fucking eat you?
Yeah, exactly. that's another kind of thing to be aware of. And the one we did in Sicily was quite new, so the Camino del Norte and the Caminos, they've been going for hundreds of years. They're very well established. Lots of other newer walks are opening up across Europe. The Sicilian one we did, I think, is maybe about 5 years old, so it's very, very new. And they obviously haven't built up that relationship with the local community in terms of, like, the farmers seeing the benefit of these tourists coming through their land. So that's kind of why they just let their dogs off, because they're just like, well, no, fuck these guys, we don't care. So I think, like, that's something that the people who've created this walk, and we met and spoke with a few of them, but they're like very conscious of this as an issue, and are like working with the communities and the farmers to fix it. But obviously it takes time to kind of get to a place where they can, not have an issue with a major issue with dogs, basically.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. But luckily we didn't get attacked by dogs. But as I said, on the Facebook group, there are people who are reporting, like, I got attacked today in this area. Watch out if you're walking through there tomorrow, kind of thing.
Jeez. It Christ.
Yeah.
Story time. Charlie, can you leave us with a story from Russia?
Yes, of course. So I think this is my most ridiculous travel story. Have you ever been to Russia, Phil?
Nope.
No, it's a pretty crazy country, as I'm sure you can imagine. I went in 2018, which for football fans, I'm talking about soccer, I guess, for your North American audience, but it was obviously 2018 was the Football World Cup in Russia. I've got to also do a disclaimer that I'm not interested in football in the slightest. I'm not really a big sports guy, but I wanted to go to the World Cup in Russia because if you had a football ticket, you didn't need a visa to go to Russia during that period. So and the visas were like maybe £200 or something like that, whereas a football ticket's about £50. So I sort of saw it as like, okay, this is a good way for me to get into Russia. I'll see a bit of football and, you know, I'll explore Moscow and St. Petersburg and I'll have a great time. Also my brother was there. My brother, definitely someone you should maybe talk to, Phil, but he'd cycled from the UK to Russia, which is insane. Okay. And then after Russia, he then cycled from St. Petersburg to Portugal and then across into Africa and went as far south as Liberia before he flew home. So he did a mental journey. So anyway, he was out there in Russia, so I was like, okay, my brother's out there, I'll go there, we'll have a good time. England were doing very well in the football. We won the game that I'd had my ticket to, so I was very happy.
What did you see?
So I had a ticket to England versus Colombia. England won on penalties, which was, you know, a huge thing for England. Like we've previously been historically very poor at penalties, so to kind of win on penalties was this like incredible thing. And I was definitely starting to get very swept up in the atmosphere, the chanting, the drinking, you know, just the socializing with all the other British England fans. But I had plans to go to St. Petersburg, so I was like, okay, well, England are going to go and play in another part of Russia, I'll go to St. Petersburg, and I'll explore, you know, that city. So I got the train to St. Petersburg, just walked to the train, you know, walked on the train. In the UK, you can just walk on any train. It's absolutely fine. On my way to St. Petersburg, no bother, got to the train station, bought a ticket, job done. And then England won that other game that they were playing. So then we were through to the semi-final. And this was the first time England had been in the semi-final in about 30 years. So everyone was like, oh my God.
Did you even invite the
sport? Yeah. Yeah. The first time we've been in the semi-final for years. And it was like, oh my God, I need to get a ticket. Every English person in Russia was like, I need to get a ticket desperately. As I mentioned, my brother was still in the country. He was in Moscow. And he had two friends fly out from England to hang out with him in Moscow, and they obviously needed tickets as well. So they were like, they managed to find tickets in St. Petersburg for three people, and my brother was like, hey, Charlie's in St. Petersburg, he can get our tickets for us. They were $500 a pop, so $1,500. And then I was told my brother, like, you need to get me a ticket because I've got yours, like, you need to find me a ticket in Moscow and I'll bring you the tickets and everyone be happy. So the game was on the Wednesday night. I spent Tuesday going to multiple different cash machines around St. Petersburg, getting out my $1,500. For some reason, you can get dollars out of the cash machine there. So I got out my $1,500. I think it was like $250 a time was the maximum. So I had to go to multiple different banks to get all this money. I went and met a German couple in a hotel. They gave me the tickets. I gave them the money. Sorted. I was like, great. I can go back to my hostel. I can sit down. I'll get the train to Moscow tomorrow. My brother sorted me a ticket, $400 for mine. So I got a slight deal versus what he paid. Jobs are good and everything was like fine. So went to sleep, woke up the next day, got the Uber to the train station, and that's when things started to go wrong, because I was like, oh, one train to Moscow please, and they were like, no, it's completely fully booked, there's no way you can get on, like, you don't have a seat. I was like, well, I'll just stand, because in the UK, if you don't have a seat, you just stand. That's like a normal thing for us. But it's like in Russia, that's not how it works. Like, you have to have a booked seat and you have to sit in that for the journey. There's no standing, there's no other option. And I was like, okay, well, what about the next train? They're like, no, all trains all day from St. Petersburg to Moscow are full. It's like, ah, fuck. And like, had I just been on my own and didn't have £1,500, sorry, dollars of my brother and his friend's money in my pocket, I'd be like, okay, whatever, I'll watch it on TV, fine. I was like, I can't. I've got to get these tickets. So the game was at 9 p.m. By this time, it's about 11 a.m. And I was like, right, fine, I'll go to the airport. Got an Uber to the airport. Went up and was like, when's the next flight to Moscow? Oh, it's in 2 hours. Great. One ticket, please. No tickets. Okay, when's the one after that? Same thing happens. All the flights from St. Petersburg to Moscow are fully booked. And I'm like, I'm counting down the clock now. It's getting to about 12, you know, midday sort of time. And I'm like, holy shit, like, I need to get to Moscow. and I was looking on my Google Maps, and I was like, okay, if I drive, it's a 9-hour drive. It's 700 kilometers, I think, something like that, 700 or 800 kilometers. It's a 9-hour drive. It's now 12 o'clock. I get a car now. I can get to Moscow in time for kickoff at 9 o'clock. This is the perfect window. I've got enough time. So I went and got a car from the airport car rental, which obviously, you know, as ever with car rental and airport, just takes an age because they're going through all the documents, blah, blah, blah. The woman expressly said, like, you cannot leave St. Petersburg in this car. And I was like, yep, sure. No plans to leave St. Petersburg. Obviously, I knew that was bullshit. They have tracking devices in cars, but I was like, you know, whatever. We're just going to do it. She took me to the car, and then she was like, oh, I've got the wrong keys. I'm going to have to go back and get the right keys. And I was like counting down the clock. Like, it's like F1 drivers, you know, like split seconds in the pit stop. It was like, I'm losing like my timings here. So I eventually got on the road at like 12:30 to do this 9-hour drive. So I was like, well, I need to speed here for hours and hours and hours across Russian roads. There was a highway that was like half finished. So some of it was on that, but a lot of the Russian roads were just like bumpy off-road, kind of what you can imagine from driving through rural Russia. And a lot of weird shit happened. Like there was a storm, like a huge storm at one stage. It was like, I was driving through, like flies were coming into my car, like giant flies were in one area. I couldn't work out how to operate like the gas pump because obviously it was all in Russian and it was like a self-service thing. There were no people in this gas station, so I was like, how the fuck do I fill up my car in Russian? All this sort of stuff going on. And meanwhile, I was like texting my brother. I was like driving, texting. I was doing well over the speed limit. My brother was like, where the fuck are you? Like, I've got your ticket, blah, blah, blah. I was like half worried that the police were going to pull me over. So I had my $400 for my ticket in my hand, basically. So if I got pulled over, I'd give them $100 and I'd just keep going. And that's my, you know, later, just bro. Ready yeah. for it. And then, so I was texting my brother, as I said, the stadium was in southwest Moscow. I was coming from the north. So he was like, look, I've spoken to a Russian. They're telling me you need to park here in north Moscow because you can't drive across Moscow. That's like insane. You'll be in traffic. So park here in the north, get the metro from here to here and here to here. Like, okay, fine. So I eventually, after hours and hours of driving, like adrenaline for hours and hours of like this stress that I was experiencing during this journey, looking at my clock constantly. I don't know if you can see it on there.
Dude, that's huge, dude.
It's basically the length of the UK, but it obviously in Russian terms it's pretty small, but in terms of like British terms it was pretty long. And I was texting my mates obviously back home, and they're all just like absolutely pissing themselves laughing because of this hilarious situation I'd found myself in. And my brother was texting me. It was like his two buddies who are twin brothers had started fighting because of the stress, and they were like having a physical fight. And he was like, what's going on? And
I'm gonna miss the fucking game.
Exactly. They'd flown from the UK to Moscow for this game for like 1 day or 2 days only. And they were like, you know, there was lots of stress going on. Anyway, I got to this place in the north of St. Petersburg, just literally parked my car on the fucking side of a park, like just ran and just went for it. Got on the tube, got out of the tube, met the guys, and we just like pegged it into the stadium. Just as like God Save the Queen was going on, the national anthem, we could just like, we've made it. Oh my fuck. Like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. There was like relief. And like, there's photos of me, like selfies and stuff from being there. I was just like drenched in sweat. I'm just like, I look horrendous. I don't look anything like myself. England scored after 5 minutes. So it was like another like huge.
Who were they playing?
They're playing Croatia. Yeah, they were playing Croatia. So England scored after 5 minutes, like another exhilaration, like, oh my God, yeah, we made this. This is the best day ever. And then like in kind of classic England football, you know, performance, it just got worse and worse from there. Croatia equalized in the second half. So it went to extra time. So there was another 30 minutes added on. And just at the end of the additional 30 minutes, Croatia scored another goal. And it was just like the wind had been knocked out of my sails. It's like the whole adventure, like, could have had the perfect ending, just had like depression and sadness. And I was just like, oh no, I need a drink. So we went and found a bar. All everyone was like, oh, you know, really sad, we're going home. Had a drink, and just found a hotel and just crashed. And then the issue was, after this whole depressing day, I had to get the car back to St. Petersburg. So the next day I had to drive all the way from Moscow to St. Petersburg again. Obviously much more leisurely, I stopped for McDonald's, like, you know, enjoyed myself a little bit more, but I had to do it all again, got it back to the woman who'd originally rented it for me, and she was like, I told you not to take it outside of St. Petersburg. I was like, you know, what are you going to do about it? I got back to the parking garage and there was just a Russian policeman stood there, and he was like, you're not coming in. And I was like, I can't speak Russian, so I don't understand why I can't come in. But I was like, this is a rental, like, I need to give it back, like, I can't just drive off and keep the car, which is what he seemed to be suggesting I do. He was like go home. I was like, I will go home, but like, I need to put the car back in its home before I can go home. And then, yeah, it was just a really deflating experience after so much adrenaline and kind of, you know, nonsense that had happened. And then I flew home the next day from St. Petersburg, and obviously England, you know, were out of the tournament and the dream was dead, kind of thing. But it was just a very mad experience driving across Russia, let me tell you.
What an adventure. 18 hours fucking
in 2 days for nothing.
Fuck, man, that's intense, man. Quite an adventure, dude.
And I definitely saw more of Russia than 95% of the other England fans at that World Cup. So, you know, I saw rural Russia. I saw how people really live, like, outside of the cities. And yeah, it's not very nice, to be honest. It's a lot of poverty, a lot of shacks by the side of the road, but, you know, it was interesting at least.
Yeah, dude, that's intense, dude. Listen, man, thanks so much for coming on. I want us to continue this conversation if possible. I want to jump on the Patreon, and I want to, I'd like to share a story as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little birdie told me that you might have a story in Dublin and you might have one in Mexico as well.
I can't think of what it might be, but let's yeah, we can chat.
Yeah, anyways, let's jump on the Patreon. So thank you so much for coming on. Guys, go check out Hungry Ghost podcast, available on all platforms. Charlie, thank you so much. You were so much fun.
Thank you so much, Phil. Thank you for listening as well.
Thank you for listening to Two Beers Till Takeoff. Do you want free additional content or just to stay connected with the show? Then give us a follow on our social media platform. That means TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, all of them. Are you in need of podcast production services, video editing, or anything in between? Then look no further than Strut Sound Productions, the official producer of the Two Beers Till Takeoff podcast. Music produced by Alex Gagne. Check out his work in our show notes. Voiceover done by Viking Leo K. See you next week on Two Beers Till Takeoff.